From Australian Book Review, this is the ABR podcast, home to some of the magazine's finest reviews, interviews, poetry, fiction, and commentary. My name is Peter Rose, and I'm the editor of ABR. From time to time, the ABR podcast is devoted to individual poets whose work continues to resonate long after their death. Last June, it was Gwen Harwood on the occasion of her centenary. This week, we turn to Frances Webb, born 5 years after Harwood in 1925, but shorter lived. First, we're joined by John Hawke, poet, Monash University academic, and poetry editor of ABR. He talks about Webb's singular poetic oeuvre. Then Ian Dixon, ABR theatre critic and a fellow devotee of Webb's work, reads one of his greatest poems, John Hawke.
Frances Webb, who was born in 1925, was widely regarded amongst his contemporaries as probably the most gifted Australian poet of his generation. And he was warmly supported throughout his very unsettled life by close friendships with fellow poets such as Rosemary Dobson and Nan MacDonald. His first major poem, A Drum for Ben Boyd, appeared in book form when he was only 22. Webb had begun publishing poems in The Bulletin as a teenager, and his work was strongly supported by its editor, Douglas Stewart. The majority of Webb's poems would appear in The Bulletin, and through Stewart's imprint, Angus and Robertson. Webb was a brilliant student in high school, but he was unable to complete university, concentrating instead on his poetry, which was very prolific during these early years. He wrote most of the work gathered in his collected poems before the age of 40. This was due to the increasingly difficult circumstances of his institutionalisation in a variety of psychiatric facilities, both in Australia and in England, where he was one of the first patients to receive ECT. His final book, Ghost of the Cock, published in 1964, collected writings from this later period, but he completed only a handful of poems in the remaining decade of his life, before his early death at the age of 48. Psychiatric records indicate that the circumstances of his illness during this time were much more severe than has been generally acknowledged. Webb apparently had a recurring nightmare in which the collected poetry of Douglas Stewart would appear floating above his bed. And the influence of Douglas Stewart's celebrated verse dramas, such as The Fire on the Snow, is evident in Webb's choice of Ben Boyd as a subject here. His next major poem would be about another semi-mythic historical figure, Ludwig Leichhardt. Taking their cue from Kenneth Slezer's Five Visions of Captain Cook, Australian poets and artists of this period were engaged in an early reassessment of our national myths, mainly focusing on colonial hero figures and explorers, a movement that would culminate in the publication of Patrick White's Voss in 1957. But Douglas Stewart's approach in particular was shaped by the Nietzschean ideas of his mentor, Norman Lindsay. And dubious projections of Nietzschean will are evident in Stewart's depiction of figures such as Ned Kelly. Lindsay would provide illustrations for the published version of A Drum for Ben Boyd, but Frances Webb grew increasingly suspicious of the Lindsayan creed, especially for its anti-Semitism. This would lead him to write a verse drama called Birthday about the final days of Adolf Hitler, which was broadcast on the BBC in 1953. This rejection of the Lindsayan ethos of creative effort becomes increasingly marked in Webb's later writings, and he turned especially to his Catholic faith as a means of countering these influences. Webb's own personal humility and modesty about his work were often noted by those who knew him. As the critic Harry Heseltine commented, after the early poems on Boyd and Leichhardt, he turned away from the contemplation of the fascist personality in others and concentrated, at what cost no one could begin to guess, on the fascist personality in himself. And Webb himself wrote in a letter to Rosemary Dobson, "Everything that I've loathed and tried to fight, I discovered bottled up in myself." Unlike Cook or Scott, Ben Boyd is a troubling anti-hero for the young Webb to have chosen as his subject. One of the wealthy settlers who arrived in Australia during the colonial period, who were handed enormous land grants with suspicious facility, Boyd is probably remembered today for his whaling activities around Eden. But he also initiated a form of slave trading, capturing slave workers from New Guinea, which was controversial even in its time. So he was the pioneer of the practice that came to be known as blackbirding. And his later career, following a period in California during the gold rush, involved the quixotic attempt to establish a kingdom of island nations, a Pacific empire, with himself as chief exploiter, which might be a suitable subject for Werner Herzog. And this led to his mysterious death in Guadalcanal. The poem leaves us in no doubt about the fact that we need to think carefully about naming public areas such as national parks and Mossman streets in commemoration of such contentious colonial figures. Webb presents this disturbing history in a mostly unvarnished form. We never hear directly from Boyd himself, but his myth is negotiated through the voices of historical figures, such as the artist Sir Oswald or William Brearley. Webb once famously wrote that truth is a mass of stops and gaps, and this fragmentary portrait is presented from multiple perspectives, none of which are especially positive or appealing. The triumph of the will described in this poem is never celebrated as heroic, but emerges as a troubling enigma within our dark and problematic history of colonisation. A Drum for Ben Boyd is written in a more direct style than Webb's later poetry, which became increasingly dense and ambiguous, and which has often been compared to the early work of Robert Lowell. Its unrhymed lines, varied on an iambic beat, are designed to be heard as well as read. The verse dramas of not only Stuart, but also of English poets such as Auden and MacNeice were popular during this period, and it was common to hear broadcasts of poetry over the radio. That's no longer the case today, so please enjoy this rare opportunity to hear Francis Webb's 1948 poem, A Drum for Ben Boyd, read by Ian Dixon.
1. From our roving reporter. Well, friends, after a very trying fortnight, you may quote us as saying that Browning and Shakespeare would have committed suicide in this country. We had promised to entertain you with the story of a strange person whom the papers have been discussing, giving you first-hand information from anyone willing to pass it on. We freely admit that the final tally is most unsatisfactory. Here are a few of the things we had to contend with. We commenced by interviewing two very old people. First, an old Norwegian boatshed owner claimed our attention. A little shambling fellow, wandering in his mind as if trapped, trying to get out. His eyes like blue stones, pitted by a plague or a vision. The stone being lifeless, its scars eager with life. And what did he give us? Why, some crazy story about a ship in his heart, like a great white swan tearing his senses, buffering madly to escape to the cool waters again. He had never seen our subject, only his yacht coming in. What could we do? We may use his story, lacking better. Next, a pioneer of the Eden district, where Boyd had actually lived. Tall, once robust, but wavering like a spring when tension runs out of it, this one only babbled about peace being murdered, about lighthouse towers, and a conspiracy to remove his name from some records, if we remember correctly. It's here in black and white. Privately, we think these two were completely insane, dramatizing themselves right to the asylum gates. Still, we must print something. The number of people lunching on secret sorrow is truly remarkable. We questioned a journalist, you know the type well, languid, unhappy mouth, with the inevitable little first volume of poems in hip pocket. He criticized the boss, the press, the theatre, and Mr. Benjamin Boyd on principle. Then a wailer, unsteady and reeking of spirits, voice like the last trump, eye like the edge of Hades. Why write about Boyd at all? He was only a... write something about whalers. Me, for instance, and so on. We dared not question him too closely, but being fair, we'll use his opinion pruned down a little. Well, after rubbing noses with these vulgar individuals, we must say that we found it delightfully pleasant taking tea with Sir Oswald Brierley in his studio, temporarily at Mossman. We are not snobs, but truly his accolade becomes Sir William well. He is most nobly slender, yet quite tall, has a fine forehead, humorous yet piercing eye. We would not presume to criticize Sir Oswald, though, if he will pardon us, he seemed a little vague for one who had travelled out from England with Boyd. Still, we have most exhaustive notes on his new picture. Next night, we had real information from the Oberon's captain, who shivered in the clamps of some island fever, nervous as a stranger in his bare, dim rooms, shuffling about near the lamp, seemingly on the alert for the dreamless reassurance of tomorrow's sun. Also from John Webster, a wistful, white-haired captain cast up and abandoned on a high stool in the city. At our questions, his bleached hands trembled with memory, sad as an old beached vessel when the tide taps its forsaken length. We couldn't interview Boyd himself, of course, but found a picture of him acting the city father with some measure of success. Possessing all of the city father's requirements, a beard, a nose, two eyes, a pair of ears, but in spite of these riches, looking about as happy as a lion in a birdcage. The picture was useless to us. We could not find any women in Ben Boyd's life, or at any rate, they refused to come forward and help us. And that is the full record of our achievements, far flimsier than your leanest expectations. We cannot even offer you a good story, and were actually reduced to accepting evidence from creatures that might be safer in cells or straitjackets. On the whole, as I said earlier, a trying fortnight. Finally, in reply to those good people who answered our questions by firing questions at us, remember that we are paid to analyze celebrities, events of current popular interest. We cannot choose the obscure young man killed in battle, and those whose one public act was their final heroism. These are the lyrics, brief fires. We cannot know them, or know their wishes. What is imagination but oneself flying back at unsuspected angles? How should we dare to blot out a human being under our own gaunt crest? Thus we choose emperors, criminals, adventurers, much of whose life lies open. And to offset what some may consider a wrong choice, what shall we tell you? That a swaying gate is no open invitation, that our adventurer wades in a foreign element past scope of headlines, a passionate, immeasurable darkness. Anyway, here's our story. 2. Author's Prologue. Light quakes over the city, contracts, drives on. The quickening and stir of music, baffling music, nomad of the heart's unease. In jags of stone, my thoughts hang perilously in silver cliffs. Huge symbols featuring strangeness, the sky's edges, ships toppling, and rigid green dead seas. Striking out so blindly, so often, I clasp some shape tortured into beauty with wet, frozen lips. Only that I too stiffen, that the will freeze, only that snippets of lightning, cords of the wind may drive my dreams onto time and break their backs. It is in the dawn watch, picked clean of colour and star, that the giants of the past gird on forgotten power. In this crazy wandering light that the wind's pulse flicks on and off, when the lamps and the end of the street shake up in a pocket of dust and the roofs of the houses daze headlong into a grey gulf of annihilation, stray drama comes lurching home like a late drunkard. Through the cockcrow scuffle and tremor, Ben Boyd comes striding. This is his world now. One thought's a drum for Ben Boyd. This is his life, the churned up light and the dust, a tattered scrap of life in the cubicles of memory with moths of forgetfulness, now and then out for an airing in the tangent flash of an old man's yarn, some yellow newsprint unearthed, or the dregs of a reminiscence at Twofold Bay. You and I, surgeons with scathing knives of perspective, may watch the present, the second dissolution piercing his fibres, draining his face of feature, and his groping, luminous eye fading, drying out. Far under our blazing barracks of the sun, where only the spent rains sink out of memory and bone grapples bone in uncouth heraldry, one man's soul scatters its weathering fragments. Shreds of laurel crumble in the brains of friends. Hooked barbs of venom rust with an enemy. Perhaps the true balance lies with some quiet woman who will not shriek accusations to struggle through the choking green smoke of the grass, nor will her love flicker and throb from the smoulder of fine words. All who met this man mangled a shadow, seized on some trophy, brush of a fleet quarry, and he, whose arm was longest and flourished most, threw signs on history, set the clock of rumour, though all that he held was a tremor, a half-truth, and the cunning essence had twisted away and escaped him. No plough probes deeply enough to question dust. No power claps palate and lips to gnawed concavities, for earth's tenacious silence locks these up. I follow charts of guesswork, shape a cloud, formless, unplotted, rotten with endless chains, and the sky's blue mockery plummeting through its heart. Yet truth itself is a mass of stops and gaps. 3. 1842. An immense shaking of the sun on the little flat waves of the harbour, and a young town grown from myths of the world's end, where the South is a swaggering fantasy, not yet sober. Quiet are the blue-notched heads, quiet the ticking of the spray. We barter our one grey albatross and rearing tonnage of swirl for a leaning shore, land birds, an officious cutter. The wanderer, swaying like a mirage of snow country, drifts in safely, while all the paunchy loafers near the dockside gape at an apparition so wholly lovely, plumaged with softness, yet diamond-beaked, with purposeful bowsprits of destiny. Trumpets and adulation here take over. The original impact and dream rest with the sea. 4. A boat builder. I, Jan Strindberg, boat builder from Voss Vangen, came to this colony through strife and hunger, forsaking my life work, leaving epics behind me. Now I polish hackneyed shells that the officers may regale their ladies on a summer Sunday. Appropriate giggles and comment on strong forearms, scuttling like crabs for shelter when the southerlies beat up. Burning for one fierce second, protagonist of a world tangled in flame, despair and darkness, I saw the wanderer glide in. knew it was gliding into my last defenseless anchorage. No ripple foreshadowed a remorseless entry. No warning gun snapped at those pallid boughs. Death came upon me, strangling peace and reason, and his grey swollen trappings people my heart. Fragments of lyrical mountains, tall splintered timbers, piled up like breastworks, guarding a fjord's gnarled ice. And then the lithe craft, chips cracked from hardihood, spinning about the globe, diving into change, ploughing the vicious weathers, splitting infinity like a rotted stump in the path. All these rear up in my backwater of life, in my declension. I have chosen bread for dreams, the hearth place for action, safety for courage, shutters and a candle for stars. Handed over my youth for an old man's ironic caution. And now that thing garrotted, like a slain mistress, comes back only to upbraid and scorch. Dark lord of the waters, you of the wind-bellied mantle, lord beyond fate, what have you killed this day? A ship or two in an hour? Some few fools drowned or starved? And a few gulls choked with squall? But I, here, polishing rowlocks, am safe. 5. Journalist. A new ship's in. Dirt cheap at sixpence per line. A trim job, too, but a bit willowy for yours truly. 500 tons or above is my margin of safety. 12 brass guns. If only they paid per gun, I'd paint her as the king's fleet. Brass guns for gesture and swivel mounts fore and aft for execution. Now for the weather. Halcyon, dancing wavelets. A line or two on the salute with blank charge. Rather like the boss, elevated and spitting out nothing. The owner's good copy. Of illustrious family, descendant of some laird of something or other, of princely means, damn him. I can see his future plain as the boss's nose, since everyone's bowing and scraping. With those eyes like talons, that blackguard confidence, he'll grind out a fortune, rule this blasted colony, while I sit here rotting slowly between editions. 6. Ringed with £1,000,000, the name of Boyd shuffles the horizon like some monstrous hand spanning the island, idly pulling strings of trade, half cynically toying with rumours of banks and land. And a monster grows in gossip, above common greed, eyes like huge cartwheels running in jealous flame. Hides, tallow, wool, and human brains and blood revolve before him, tempting a ravenous dream. We, who know small ambitions, are yet pliant, turning like creeks to avoid each obstinate feature that reason jams in our way. But this is a giant, rolling boulders aside and daring nature. 7. Sir Oswald Brierley. You will not find me lurking in the shadows with lips tensed to erupt some boiling truth, nor quivering in some dusty photograph as a queer white sign glowering mortality, not even as an echo, 50th part of substance, nor as the wavering line of a submerged city, though you stare at zenith noon with sun behind you. True to myself, I grew colourless, left no self-portrait. Why battle for a foothold in common thought? I waged too many battles in myself, the fratricidal shock of elements natural to each other, like high clouds running counter to the earth wind. Wits wrestled fingers, and what bird struggling home drops a careful pinion for posterity? Ben Boyd? just another element, no more human than the air we breathe, yet it brings life. I always think of him as something past purpose, insensate, battering cliffs with a forehead fruitless and obstinate as the surf. And yet the air for miles around any cliff is charged with countless poems, mostly unwritten. Something draws you to a cliff. You see yourself enlarged. And sometimes you hate the surf, as sometimes I hated Boyd. You feel ominous currents dragging you away from humanity. But passing on, you do not quickly forget such magnitudes. While I wait quietly, his town falls, stone by stone. Gossip seeks newer ventures. Sometimes a tale lags about like smoke on the sluggish wharves. A tale of death in various distant places and in the wildest garb you could well think of. A duel across a table in California. A slow starvation in a derelict yacht. A lonely struggle on some cannibal island. Always the tale brings death. No hope, no pity keeps me away from the canvas, but there's something missing. I paint from memory mostly, build a landscape crowded with whaling ships, but all at anchor, and rarely venture out beyond the shoreline. Something in my brain is atrophied, fallen away. And this, I suppose you could say, is Boyd, or something about him. 8. A whaler. A dressed-up ape with a patronizing stick, pointing you out to his friends as a sound machine, capable of so many tricks when fed on threepence. That's Mr. Blasted Boyd. He owns us all and cracks the whip too often for my liking. The shepherds are spitting froth, twice as many sheep to nurse for half the pay. But they're all the same, these yellow little rats burrowing into the land. They give you a smile and words like knives when behind you. Give me the water, miles from the smell of them. Our niggers think that after the sea's got them, they can become killers and streak out fathoms down with the certainty of spiking their teeth into something. Pretty smart for niggers. They hate the city too. When dirty air's in my mouth and everyone's yapping, I think of the water, lonely and asking nothing, with no whales inspecting you through a monocle and a clean wind not stained with rotten cabbages. I think of the grey rain smothering our lights, of the sun rattling through black and silver foam, of the chase with my hands blistering on the sweep, of the butting squalls and the days of green quietness. Then there's only one thing left, to get drunk and frighten a policeman. 9. A Papuan Shepherd. Through the thick morning steam they took shape, with fierce white symbols shaking above them in air. Sea monsters from icy regions bringing cold tides with them. Some of us trembled and clapped our hands slowly in fear, while others fingered their spears and stones in doubt. But when flame sprang and spirits squeaked overhead, and an incredible thunder troubled the trees, we crouched in terror lest our sky drip blood. And then the men, with bloodless, brittle faces, with ferocious prayers, solemn and rhythmical, seized many of us, the young and the virile, dragging us through the surf to impure burial in the berries of their tamed monsters. So we saw our gods fall back, defeated, to the green lands, fading into mist, leaving us to struggle with rages and subtleties that no one understands. Out in these bare places, a poison wrings power from my arms. Each new night spits ice, and I am forgetting the songs and the careless fishing, the old fighting, and the old peace. 10. Brierly dreams of a studio, the governor's portrait, grave magisterial duties, of evening's wrangle with planes of a sailing colour and trapping snaky clippers. But Boyd dreams of cities, bleeding the hardy pastures with new wounds, of dead whales scarring the beaches, of the gulls haunting their epic tumbling skeletons, of churches and pubs at decent intervals, and packets with old names curled about their bows, running deft passage, urged by steam and sail, sniffing out merchandise at curious inlets, forerunners of coasts subdued by facade and wall. Out of fools and incredulity, Boyd built his town, ran the whole baffling range of a mad whim, and, which was wilder, held it a dizzy second before the foundering and the plunge. Summary of Knossos and sweep of Nineveh, the cities feed only on a common will, yet all the poetry of a tower's ascent leaps out most powerfully in its rocking and fall. 11. Politician. This is a good man for a colony like ours, our little outpost on the fringe of lawlessness. He comes of a good stock and will prove valuable as a check to our rather crude, undisciplined peasantry. I like the suggestions of power and tradition which stamp this man a leader. He drinks only in his own company, has a good conservative beard and a noble bearing, though perhaps his eyes are a little too cool and grey at close quarters, and his haste impedes our necessary documentations. For his toil among the poor benighted heathen, teaching them hard work with a most Christian savour, I have nothing but praise. We must close our eyes a little to the goings-on rumoured from that town of his. We all know that whalers are most godless creatures. For the rest, I am old and can always claim the privilege of office and respect, and retreat a little behind formality when I am hurried unduly. 12. A pioneer of Monero. I have loved two things deeply, the earth and silence, two giant bulks furrowed in cold harmony, petrified rhythms with eternal rhythmic challenge. Peace bound me to this land, peace in three shapes, the colour, the shadow, the noiseless mountains beyond. Here, between the beach and the mystic centre, I shape a forming foothold and the future. If I have grown quiet as my land, remember that to conquer mountains, one must think as a mountain. And these still places, wherein, with no flutter or tumult, my being will gutter and dissolve, owe me one debt, that I, foe of time, be not utterly extinguished. Who robs me of this due has my only hatred. I know this Boyd, a builder of lighthouse towers maintained for his craft only, let others perish. That squared stone is his own monument. He has given us other samples of his building, an evil town veined with corruption and murder, clinging like a swollen leech to the bay's lips. He does not love this country. Why come here, trampling my peace, trampling my very life? He holds all the cards. Even time is with him. Time. Lover of anything gaudy, hollow, rotten. If he and I were dead, I might grapple his ghost. No money or influence could help him then, and yet I should go down. He is the stronger. Time and a legend stealing my name from the earth. 13. After the groups at corners, the upraised fist, the perennial bewilderment of the suddenly unemployed, comes uncertainty. A pause for the reefing and twist of new events and patterns in the dark perspective of future. A time when the present is null and void. And the man on the bridge of his own self-scuttled wreck? You cannot picture him broken or prostrate. Success was the terror that might have tensed his back to an unnatural arc, turned him away, outpatient, healed, and thoroughly dead to his right mind and fate. There were no ghosts, no phantom, cheering crowds, no flapping of the air with guns from an anchored schooner. None watched the yacht tack quietly with leaning shrouds towards storm, and one line in an outgoing sailing list. Sailed, Wanderer, RYS, Mr. B. Boyd, owner. And savouring the sea blow, quivering with release, new visions homing the hawk to his grey-cragged eyes, the fallen gentleman now feels the only peace possible to flame-like hearts, the piling up of driftwood, new fuel of enterprise. Now for his friends is the time of dusk and rumour, echoes picked up in the wind and whirled about, talk of gold, talk of a raging dreamer, gunduels, silence. In the flung surf of his name, white candles fume and sputter and die out. 14. The Captain of the Oberon. I had never before held death, pale and polished in my hands, nor dreamed it so round and empty and motionless. Interesting job, I thought, quite a touch of romance, the search for a dead man's skull to placate some vault, with a useful bonus if the search proved successful. And I'll admit that the man had intrigued me, a fairy tale customer with a trick of vanishing, leaving a score of yarns. But I could fool him with a government charter behind me to track him down if alive, or ransom his bones. Find the skull, they reckoned, and we know all the secrets. Well, I've done that, but something triumphs here, and it's not their triumph. Something over my shoulder keeps repeating that this in my hands is a guess. Or maybe a lie. The usual dull slog through the islands with the sky quivering, gasping for air, the water oily and steaming, and a pillar of squall moving here and there. At Guadalcanal, a couple of smashed canoes rotted to paper thickness. The long, flat beaches, empty of motion, but shaken with wandering sounds. Then a maddening haggle with the local savages, almost a gunpoint bargain, you may say, finally to receive this small grey shell, streaked in places by green lines of fungus. As I said before, he has the laugh on me, leans over my shoulder, mocking the thing I clutch and poise and balance. Dead men have the power to mock us even when we juggle their actual bones. They have slipped clean out of illusion, and they grow. 6 feet when he died, this fellow would top a cloud. The thing's too full of ghosts. I hate the feel of it. Holding it is like splintering a mirror and finding 1,000 faces round your boots. 15. John Webster. Perhaps I foresaw the future of this last voyage. Boyd's schemes losing touch with realism, hands flickering and nervous, eyes baffled. Though when Gold Rush struck on a barren core and his search was just another giant failure, he didn't care tuppence, positively seemed to rely on a chain of failures. God alone knew his ambitions. Perhaps money was running short. That would clip his wings and cage him up in normality. Perhaps, though he talked with the usual gust and force, he realized well that his scheme of island republics appeared to his friends and his foes and himself as a sign, as the first cairn on a final road to madness. I am growing old. My eyesight trembles badly, so the facts of the past are my only speculation. I can see now that as we left San Francisco, the glittering house fronts and those cold blue hills dropping in rigid folds out of the sky and the small buff windmills slowly turning over, we might have prophesied, hoisted a black sail. Once out in the mist, taking the falling weather, Boyd seemed to drink in colour. When he spoke, you almost saw flesh and ribs within his schemes. You saw a new state in the tropics, a huge army. But more often came this new weapon of irony turned in against himself. Something was shifting and breaking up. Some power that had held his eyes turned outward only. The end came none too soon. Here, when my thoughts seek his last desperate day, all's torn and arrested, starting from a blank matrix. A dark, upflung arm hangs suspended, glistening. A thrown spear, whistling in its arc like a comet, bristles with knots of flame and points and violence. An eyeball glares like a sovereign by candlelight, or a fired canoe eddies, its prow snaps upward like the jaws of a transfixed shark. Boyd that morning started off alone, with a cheerful warning to all game within gunshot. His blurred shape grappled with the outskirts of the unknown. I saw him pause a long moment, like a swimmer before the plunge into green, opaque density. Would not that have pleased him, unpredictable as he called himself, not to be tied down, that his final appearance was not as the half-corpse, intangible bedclothes with an odour of crepe and tears, but as a shadow at the distant end of a tunnel of sunlight. For his last office, a couple of shots rapped out like sharp commands, and a moment's peace over the whole island.
Thanks for listening to the ABR podcast. We hope you'll join us again next week. If you enjoyed this episode, why not consider subscribing to ABR? Subscriptions start from just $10 per month for digital. Visit our website for more information. We'd like to thank Jack Khalil and Clancy Balin, who edit the podcast, as well as our contributors who take the time to read their articles and creative writing. And if you enjoy listening to the ABR podcast, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes.